More and more people want to minimize their lives, including the place they live. But tiny houses are still not allowed in Athens-Clarke County.
We figured we'd try to push the envelope and get about as small as we can.
Habitat for Humanity's Spencer Fry on kind of tiny homes. This is Athens News Matters from WUGA. I'm Chris Hsu.
And I'm Alexia Ridley. We'll also talk about ways that seniors on a fixed income can afford rising energy costs.
A senior goes to cut their furnace on, it's not working. And what do you do when you're low income?
Those stories, plus our panel of commentators.
Don't take me down the road telling me that our schools are failing, that they need to be completely transformed, when we have figures in the community who have graduated from these institutions and are going on to lead very successful careers.
Coming up on Athens News Matters.
Morning Edition is everywhere.
Monroe, Sao Paulo, Beirut,
London. Reporting from bunkers, alleys, jungles, and deserts. But most importantly, we're wherever you are. Start your day with a trip around the world and wake up with Morning Edition from NPR News.
This is Athens News Matters from WUGA. I'm Chris Shoup.
And I'm Alexia Ridley. Joining me for our weekly news and politics panel are Athens-Clarke County Commissioner Russell Edwards and WUGA's political editor Martin Matheny. Let's start with, once again, the Clarke County Board of Education and the most recent developments as far as tensions between some board members and Superintendent Damon Means. Russell, you spoke at the board meeting last week.
Well, I spoke that night. I complimented the board members for collaborating with the Athens-Clarke County Commission. We had a great joint meeting a few weeks ago where we discussed property issues and workforce development, some interesting facts that came out from our planning department. About 413 permits for single-family homes have been pulled in the Cleveland Road Attendance District in the past year. So that's valuable information for us to pass on to the school board members who are currently working through a future facility use program and plan. And then we also had a great discussion about workforce development and the developments over at the Athens Career Academy, some of the new programming that's been established there, a cosmetology program that's been critically acclaimed, I guess you could say. So it was a great meeting of the minds. You know, around the table I looked, we had the practically the entire mayor and commission and with the school board members there. So, you know, I just wanted to take a moment there at that meeting to try to uplift the conversation, take it to a higher level, try to stay positive, try to stay optimistic, try to express my support for school board members who are doing the hard work every day, you know, to represent their constituencies and do the best they can.
Yeah, I think it's important to mention, you know, we've talked a lot, especially on this program, about the school district and about these ethics issues and these tensions between the superintendent and some members of the board. But I think it's also worth mentioning, I know we've all been around town a good amount of time, and I don't think, you know, the history of sort of commission school board relations has been sort of a sometimes chilly, non-existent one. And so mm-hmm. I think we ought to recognize the fact that there seems to be kind of a closer relationship and both bodies sort of sitting down and thinking about the future and how they can help each other. So I think that's worth acknowledging.
It's a productive use of time. You know, both bodies make tremendously consequential decisions for the entire county. So it only makes sense for us to work together as much as we can. So I'm hopeful. Every day when I drop my son off to school at Barrow Elementary and see the smiles on all the teachers' faces and getting to know the administrators, you know, there are some phenomenal professionals that work in our schools every day, and there's some who have been working for decades and are pillars of our community. So I'd just like to take a moment, take it to another level and say thank you to our teachers and express my undying support for our teachers who are there every day, Monday through Friday. And you know, I don't see them bickering at the school board meeting. I don't see them bickering at the county commission meeting. You know, they're at home grading papers and calling parents and trying to do the best job that they know how to do to make our community a better place. So, you know, I think we all need to sort of take a moment and express our support for the teachers who really have been working hard for some of them for decades, and they deserve our support. You know, we've come a long way in this district. Some folks forget that before Dr. Lanoue, our graduation rate was 50%. After his tenure, 79%.
You know, which is a huge increase.
It's a huge jump. You know, we've made strides in this community. It's not like just yesterday we found out we had problems. You know, and these are complex problems, right, that deserve discussion, that deserve questions, that deserve buy-in from various stakeholders. So, you know, it never was meant to be some sort of top-down operation. You know, this is a democratic institution that's protected by the Georgia State Constitution. So they're going to sort that out in the central office. They can have it. But all I can do is express support for our teachers and my gratitude for our teachers and encourage people to come to the school board meeting to take part, to witness to what's going on, and to show solidarity.
Yeah, and I think it's worth noting, too, that, you know, the administration and the school board need to get this sorted out. This is not a good look for Clark County Schools, and I'm kind of worried about what kind of signal this is sending. I mean, one thing about Clark County is that we have a lot of really engaged people. So like you said, Russell, it's not a top-down thing. You're going to have to deal with public input at some point.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, I've learned this as a commissioner. You know, if you want to get things done, you've got to get buy-in from the stakeholders. You've got to have more people invested in the process so that they will dutifully be on the team and help execute the game plan to help resolve the problems that you're working on. You can't be on an island issuing edicts and attacking people. You've got to put your plan out there and answer questions and incorporate feedback from the various stakeholder groups. So that to me is the recipe for success in a democratic institution.
Well, well said, Russell, because I know we do need to remember the teachers. They may not have the visibility, but they certainly are impacted by whatever decisions are made. And then that falls to the students as well.
Right. And, you know, our teachers, they're a resilient bunch. You know, they get new policies and standards handed down every year, some from the state, some from the local school board. But they persevere and they keep on going and they keep on going and doing their best. And you know what, folks? They're not in it for the money. You know, I'm doing it for the money, said no teacher ever. They're doing it because they love the kids. They love serving the community. So we need to honor that by respecting our teachers, respecting their autonomy in the classroom, and trusting our teachers that they're going to do the best they can.
You know, I went through 12 years in Clark County School District, so I'm an alum of the system. We've always had, I could probably name check a dozen or more great teachers that I had, you know, a long time ago.
And that's an important voice, Martin. You know, the fact that you are a product of the local school system, you are a success story, you can testify.
Well, let's not go too
you
far.
You know, let's not, you know, Patrick Davenport, mm-hmm. graduate of Cedar Shoals. So don't take me down the road telling me that our schools are failing, that they need to be completely transformed, when we have figures in the community who have graduated from these institutions and are going on to lead very successful careers. Oh, so right. It's not entirely broken.
Yeah.
Well, this issue will certainly continue to come up, and Russell, you are welcome to come back and discuss it with us on the show.
Sure.
We are going to move on now to another Athens-Clark County matter, and that is the resignation of Central Services Director David Fluck, who was over animal control as one of his many departments under him. But so he resigned, and one of the big things that drew so much attention, even so far as to have Commissioner Tim Denson holding a meeting about animal control, was the fact that 31 cats were euthanized in July, and that just garnered a lot of discussion in the community, and then eventually, I think, led to his being asked to resign, some of the things going on there.
There had been some problems at the animal control facility, you know, and really, honestly, it needs to be called animal services. You know, we're working on changing the name.
Absolutely.
First and foremost to animal services. You know,
that's a better, it's a better grasp of what happens there.
Right. And, you know, we absolutely want to have as close to a no-kill shelter as possible. You know, we're never going to get to 100% because some animals just come in so injured. It's sad. You know, we provide palliative care before they pass away. But animal services, you know, last year we had some problems with the Georgia Department of Agriculture. This year we've had some problems with the cat euthanization. I think it was actually over 40 cats were euthanized. So that triggered a tremendous amount of community feedback from caring individuals, nonprofit partners throughout the community, and the commission acted, looked into this issue. We have pet lovers on the commission, absolutely. Commissioner Ovita Thornton is a dog lover. She's got a wonderful dog. And we are working to reorganize the government, basically, thinking about how we can optimize the services we provide to our animals here in this community, and looking to restructure that department, pull it out, and make it an independent department that reports directly to the manager, which would create just a more efficient means of communication between the commissioners and the manager. And as you know, constituents communicate to the commissioner communicates to the manager then handles the problem. So we're very much on board with resolving this issue and making our animal services facility the best it possibly can be.
And I think moving animal services, let's call it that, up to sort of a top line answers to the manager mm-hmm. position, I think that makes a lot of sense. Sort of by way of disclosure, a long time ago, 9 years ago, I was on the Athens-Clarke County Charter Review Commission. And so Central Services was one of the departments that I specifically was assigned to look at. And, you know, Central Services does a little bit of everything. You know, they do, what do they do? The IT and management, technology management for the county, but they also handle photocopying and printing.
Streets and drainage.
Right.
Solid waste.
Very diverse.
Yeah. So I think having somebody heading up Animal Services who is an expert in that field will yield to better service all around, right?
Well, that's what we're praying for, absolutely, because we need to absolutely be certain that the things that have happened in the past year can never happen again.
We are out of time for this segment. Stay with us. We're going to talk about some kind of tiny houses next. This is Athens News Matters from WUGA News.
Every day, NPR's All Things Considered includes news that keeps you ahead of the curve.
If this issue is not important enough for us to draw a line in the sand, what issue is?
Plus, the unexpected.
The wing, the skin, the neck, the heart, you're making chicken meatballs, cooking the knee cartilage.
All Things Considered from NPR News.
Welcome back to Athens News Matters on WUGA. I'm Alexia Ridley.
And I'm Chris Shoup. In recent years, so-called tiny houses have become a more significant part of the national and local discussion about affordable housing. But the problem is, traditional tiny houses, less than 600 square feet, are not currently legal in Athens-Clarke County. Athens Area Habitat for Humanity have found a promising workaround, at least in the short term, kind of tiny houses. These 600 to 800 square foot dwellings are legal in ACC and true to the spirit of tiny houses. Here to talk about tiny houses and kind of tiny houses is Spencer Fry, Executive Director of Athens Area Habitat for Humanity. Thanks for coming by today.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
Well, first of all, are there differences other than size between a tiny house and a kind of tiny house?
I think it's the kind of tiny home was a takeoff of the idea that we couldn't build a tiny home. And so we figured we'd try to push the envelope and get about as small as we can. And we held a design contest in partnership with the U.S. Green Building Council, had a bunch of entries, and this is actually an award-winning entry from a couple of students here at UGA. They may have graduated by now.
Oh, it's really cool.
Yeah, so this is going to be an incredible opportunity for the community to see how a smaller home that's also LEED certified can work in this community. So it'll have some of the highest energy efficiency available on the market today, including solar panels, and will be built to, we're hoping to get LEED certification. This will be the first two homes on the market available for sale in Athens-Clarke County as LEED certified homes.
Wow. Well, Athens-Clarke County has an affordable housing problem, as we discussed in our recent housing code hack. What role can tiny houses or these kind of tiny houses play in creating more affordable housing stock?
Well, if a home is smaller, it's going to take a lot less construction materials to build it. And the construction material market right now is pretty high because there's a building boom going on. And this gives people the opportunity for greater land use, lower electricity bills, lower water bills, really trying to make sure that a person in the home can not only afford the home itself, but the maintenance and the upkeep and the electric bill and the air conditioning with all the heat we've been having lately, the electric bills are skyrocketing. And so it's really important to incorporate all of those aspects into the project.
Well, one thing that stood out to me in getting ready for our conversation is the role that tiny homes play in living a less consumer-driven lifestyle. Why is that important, and how does a smaller house help in that?
Well, you know, a smaller house will help in that just because of the size of the square footage that you have to put stuff in, right? It's a minimalist way to live. You know, there's a culture of awareness that's kind of focusing on being less consumer-based, and I think it's a great thing to do, and we've got a lot of issues with our planet. You know, Genesis says we're the stewards of the earth, and we need to be the stewards of the earth.
Absolutely. Well, if someone is interested in moving into a kind of tiny house, either through Habitat or by building one of their own, what would you recommend they do?
Well, certainly you can speak to some local qualified builders that are licensed contractors that know about these houses, know how to do it. We haven't broken the minimum 600 square foot threshold yet with the mayor and commission, but we are working on that.
Well, finally, you originally co-sponsored this project with the U.S. Green Building Council of Georgia, but you've added some additional sponsors. Who's on the team now?
Golly, we've got so many people that have wanted to be involved with this project. Is Huber Engineered Woods. It's the people that make the flooring systems and the zip tie systems, which are the decking for the roof and the walls. And then we have Timberbuilt. David Hyde over at Timberbuilt was the president of the U.S. Green Building Council in Athens when this project started, and he's been tremendous. Emory Ratings, Jeremy Field over there has been great. They're doing our LEED certification. Athens-Clarke County is a huge sponsor because we were able to secure some federal funding to offset some of the costs that we're going to incur. And then Mitsubishi Electric, and also Lowe's. Corporate Lowe's has gotten involved, and they are so excited about this. And Lowe's on the east side is just ready to jump out on this project and get their staff over and help us get all the materials we need. And they're just being great. So it's very, very popular project.
And truly a community effort.
Sure is. It sure is.
Well, Spencer, I sure do appreciate you coming by and sharing all this with us. Spencer Fry is the executive director of Athens Area Habitat for Humanity, which breaks ground this weekend on the first two kind of tiny homes in Athens.
As we noted in our discussion with Spencer Fry, tiny houses are not currently permitted in Athens-Clarke County. So what do you do if you want to live the tiny house life? WUGA contributor Amy Scott talked to a homeowner in that situation.
Paula Loniak built her tiny house in 2016 with hopes of downsizing and saving money. Loniak has lived in Athens since 1992, but after her tiny home was constructed, she found out that zoning ordinances prohibit tiny homes from residing within Athens-Clarke County, leaving her without a place to put her home.
The day that I moved the tiny house onto some property where I thought I'd be able to live, they were there the next morning. Get out of here in less than a month. I was panicked. So that's how I found out.
Loniak is among many advocates for affordable housing in Athens and believes tiny homes may be one way to create lower-cost housing. She's been advocating for a change in legislation since she built her home. She's been so involved in advocating for tiny homes that she's even earned her own nickname.
I guess I'm getting known as the Tiny House Lady. I've been going to any kind of meeting in Athens-Clarke County that I've suspected had something related to tiny houses or housing in general, affordable housing. Plans for Athens, like the Comprehensive Plan 2018. It felt like my part-time job going to meetings. So I learned and made friends with just about every commissioner and mayor, and now they all know me by name.
Affordable housing has been part of past comprehensive plans, but the severity and urgency of the need didn't hit home until 2016, when ACC hired an outside consultant to complete a workforce housing study in Athens. The study found three main conclusions. There are more households without children, a lack of desirable new housing developments in Athens, and an increasing gap between income and housing costs. Mayor Kelly Gertz says changing regulations to allow for tiny houses will be complicated, but he wants the commission to look at a variety of solutions.
It's going to take a bunch of things. Things like auxiliary dwelling units, which is essentially, you know, what kind of in the old days you'd call the in-law suite in your backyard, is a prospect, so we want to bring that forward. look at some tinier home sizes as well, and maybe also some tinier single lot sizes. The smallest lot you can have in what's called our RS5 zone is a 5,000 square foot lot. And so I'd like us to look a little bit smaller than that.
Despite past struggles to make changes to legislation, Loniak is hopeful that the current mayor and commission will make headway towards allowing tiny homes in Athens.
I'm just, like I said, I'm cautiously optimistic, but I have a better feeling about this group of officials than previously. I really do like living in my tiny house. I just don't like where it is.
For WUGA, I'm Amy Scott.
Amy Scott is a UGA journalism student and a WUGA contributor. As Commissioner Russell Edwards noted earlier in today's program, Athens-Clarke County has had several problems in recent years with its animal control department. The recent decision to euthanize dozens of cats has led to community outcry, the resignation of the government official charged with overseeing the department, and a move to make animal control into an animal services department reporting to the county manager. District 5 Commissioner Tim Denson held a town hall this week focused specifically on the animal control situation, and he joins us to talk about what he heard and the way forward. So, Commissioner Denson, you held a town hall meeting Wednesday night about the animal shelter. What can you tell me about that meeting?
Sure, it was fantastic. We had probably well over 50 people show up very concerned about what's been going on with ACC Animal Control and wanting to know what's coming down the line to what improvements we have. County Manager Blaine Williams was there. And from the Athens Area Humane Society, we had Jane Stewart and also Lisa Milo from Athens Pets. A big important thing that we kind of talked about was the way we're moving forward is more as a partnership, getting all the stakeholders together, including those organizations and many others, so that we make sure that while we're putting these improvements in place and kind of revamping what animal services is, we're doing it the right way.
And animal services is telling things are changing a bit,
sure.
Even to the point of naming what that agency does.
Right. That's true. I mean, myself and a few of the other commissioners have been really wanting us to change that. Just, you know, the phrase animal control doesn't exactly bring about like these compassionate ideas that I think a lot of our community expects and wants and deserves. So changing the name to animal services is one of the things that we'll be voting on at the October 1st voting session next week, along with voting to actually create it as its own independent department. Up till now, it's been under central services and not really been getting the focus and expertise that it really deserves. So we'll be breaking it out into its own department. And that way, we'll also have more direct oversight from the county manager.
You know, I think of Athens as a particularly pet-friendly kind of community, definitely animal-friendly. So the idea of these quarantines, I'm sure, was difficult. But then having the animals having to be euthanized was very difficult for a lot of people. And we understand that does happen at shelters.
Sure,
people understand that. But what are you hoping to see?
You know, I think part of it's just having clear policies in place so that whenever situations do pop up, like did in the Unita quarantine, we have a clear policy of the steps they're taking, the communication lines that we go through, so that we don't end up with these casualties.
Tim Denson is the District 5 Commissioner for Athens-Clarke County. This is Athens News Matters from WUGA News.
WUGA supports the educational mission of the University of Georgia. Internships are available each semester in radio programming, production, news, and social media for students currently enrolled in college-level study. Information at WUGA.org or 706-542-3324.
This is Athens News Matters. I'm Chris Shoup.
And I'm Alexia Ridley. For many seniors, especially those living on a fixed income, the cost of energy is a continuous worry. Whether it's the cost of electricity and gas or the cost of replacing a broken air conditioner or furnace, the expense can sometimes be catastrophic. Joining us to talk about some programs that help seniors manage these expenses and provide very necessary assistance to those in need are Tim Eccles, Vice Chair of the Georgia Public Service Commission, Michael Kimsey, Executive Director of the nonprofit Hope Works, and Michael Bradford with the Salvation Army and Project Share. Commissioner Eccles, let's start with you. How important are agencies like these in helping Georgians who need assistance?
You know, when you think about problems that folks have, it may be meeting a monthly bill. And when we've got, obviously, the Salvation Army and heating energy assistance team available to help with that. But sometimes it involves a capital expenditure. Maybe something's broken, a furnace or a hot water heater, and you're on a fixed income. So Michael Kimsey's agency helps with that.
And we'll go to you, Michael, and tell us a little bit about the fact that you can actually help people get equipment so that they can have what they need.
Absolutely. We've been working in conjunction with the Public Service Commission for years. And this particular program, sponsored by Atlanta Gaslight, is really beneficial for low-income senior homeowners. We run into a lot of situations. The wintertime comes, the weather gets cold, a senior goes to cut their furnace on, it's not working. And what do you do when you're low-income? And so this particular program allows us to give them a hand up by repairing or replacing their gas furnace or gas water heater.
How does it work that someone can actually have you come in and replace something?
For those who qualify, this particular program is for seniors that are 65 and older. They have to own their own home and be living in the home. They have to meet the financial guidelines, which for our particular program is 200% of federal poverty guideline, which comes out to a little over $2,000 a month or less. And then they have to be an Atlanta Gaslight customer. But if you buy gas from one of the major gas marketers like Georgia Natural Gas, Scana Gas South, Walton Gas, then you're with Atlanta Gaslight.
And we're going to go to our other Michael to tell us a little bit about what the Salvation Army offers. It's something that some people might be more aware of, Project Share.
We have had Project Share in Georgia for almost 35 years. We started with our original partner, Georgia Power, and we have branched out to about 25 other utility donor companies, where generally speaking, the customers donate to the program. But those in need can contact the Salvation Army. They can call 1-800-25-SHARE to find out where to go in their county for assistance. And we do a general assessment of their situation, as well as looking at the crisis that they're calling us about. If their service is in jeopardy or if it's already disconnected, we can work with the utility company as well to see that we are helping them with an amount that will be effective in meeting the crisis that they are currently experiencing.
And for customers who might need assistance like that, that you help with both, say, electricity bills in the summer as well as heating bills in the winter time.
That's right. Project Share is in business 365 days a year virtually.
So have you seen any increase in particular this year, or has it been a steady need, or what have you noticed?
Well, I mean, the need is so great all the time that it's virtually a steady demand. However, we have run some analysis of the phone system and what it's trying to handle and what it does handle. And it does go up when the temperature rises, or in the winter when it falls, for sure. But and people don't realize, except those experiencing it and living it, how dangerous it is to live in too much heat.
Well, that's an interesting point, because I think, you know, we're Georgians, we're used to heat, but we're used to heat and having air conditioning. So do you see effects of that when people have been in the heat and don't realize just how damaging that is?
Yes, and even we see it on a case-by-case basis, and just statistically it's known that there are more health crises from heat than there are from the cold in the wintertime.
Right. You think, oh, I'm miserable, but no, it's actually dangerous.
Yes, it is.
And we know dangerous when it's too cold. You know, being Southern, a lot of us think the cold is just the worst. And you help people because it gets cold enough in here that if you don't have heat in your home, that can be dangerous.
That's absolutely correct.
Obviously, you want this out there. You want more people to know about what help is available for them.
Yeah, this is a win-win for everyone, really, because if the customer sitting there with a broken furnace, certainly the gas company's not benefiting from that. They're not selling any gas, so they want to sell gas. The customer needs to be warm and healthy, and this program is not fully subscribed. There's money available, an opportunity available, and that's why we're here with you today and why we want to get the word out.
I think that's something that we need to mention again, the fact that there is still money available to help people.
That's right. And the Public Service Commission was very gracious to refund us for another 5 years on this program. So we're going to be around for a while. We have funding available. We need people just to call, get in touch with us. And again, this program is for low-income senior homeowners. People have to own their home.
And you could say, well, why don't you just help everybody? Well, we don't have enough money to help everyone. We're taking what we believe is the most vulnerable population, the seniors. And if you're a landlord out there renting a house, you should have that house in good shape for people. And that's your responsibility. But in this case, we're helping a person that's on a fixed income that wouldn't be able to do it otherwise. And in this case, with Michael Bradford's program, public radio listeners may not be aware that when they check that box on the bottom of their water bill or their electric bill or their gas bill saying, I'll give a dollar to Project Share, they may not be aware that that triggers a matching contribution from the utility. And so that enables us to do even more.
Michael, what would you like people to know about your program?
I want people to know that, especially our low-income senior homeowners, that we're here for you, that you don't have to be in desperation this winter when your furnace goes out or any time during the year when your water heater goes out. We're here for you. Please call us and see if you qualify, because it can take a great burden off of you, and I know a lot of seniors live with that burden a lot of times, not knowing what to do, and we want to be there for you.
And how can people reach you?
Well, there's several ways. You can call us at 404-872-0167. Or if you're internet savvy, Hope Works, the number 4us.org.
And what would you like people to know about Project Share?
Well, I would like them to know that there's no reason to sit there and worry about their bill, about their service. And certainly no reason to sit there in the dark or without gas or facing an eviction process. And one recommendation I would have before contacting the Salvation Army, be sure that they are contacting and communicating with their utility company to let them know what kind of circumstance they're facing. But they definitely should call the Salvation Army in their community to find out when they can come in for an appointment to be assessed for Project Share. And they can also call 1-800-25-SHARE, or they can go to SalvationArmyGeorgia.org.
Can you tell me a little bit about community solar and how that works?
I think a lot of folks would love to have solar on their home, but maybe there's a tree canopy there, or maybe the roof's too old, maybe they don't own their own home. Maybe it's just too expensive for them on that. So Georgia Power has a community solar program, as well as Walton EMC and some other utilities, where you sign up for a block of green energy and you pay for, with Georgia Power, $24.99 per month. But then you get a credit back on your bill based on the performance of that panel. And in Athens, that panel is out in Comer, Georgia.
And let me ask you a final question. How does all the solar efforts that the commission approves benefit low-income customers?
It's surprising. I think when I tell people that the utility scale solar, I'm talking the large fields of solar, that it actually fractionally lowers everyone's bills. People are surprised to hear that, but we've discovered that every single ratepayer on the Georgia Power system benefits when we do solar the way that we've done most of it, and that is large fields in Middle Georgia and South Georgia, because it's cheaper than the avoided cost of energy. All that's to say that it's really cheap, and it's cheaper than coal. It's cheaper than natural gas. And when you put that kind of energy onto the grid, it lowers people's bills. So everybody is really benefiting from all of that solar we have in South and Middle Georgia.
We are out of time, but once again, I would like to thank PSC Commissioner Tim Eccles, Michael Kimsey with HopeWorks, and Michael Bradford with the Salvation Army and Project Share.
Experts say that one key to making energy more affordable is making energy sources more diverse, increasing the share of solar, wind, and other sources. GPB's Emily Jones takes us on a trip into Georgia's growing biomass industry.
From several stories up at Exelon's Albany Green Energy Plant, you can see a massive pile of chipped up wood known as biomass. A long conveyor carries it up into the plant.
Then we've got this reclaimer screw here that pulls it in, feeds it back into the plant, into the boiler.
The biomass burns to make electricity for Georgia Power. Around the corner from the wood pile, a long tube snakes off, carrying leftover steam to power a Procter & Gamble plant. From the top of Albany Green Energy, you can also see trees, just miles and miles of forest in every direction. But
we're not just going out grabbing a tree and being able to use that tree.
James Lucky is the plant manager.
Most of our fuel is coming from treetops and just mill residuals that come from paper mills or something like that.
They're burning the stuff that can't be made into lumber or paper products. Advocates in the timber industry say there's plenty of wood waste like that in Georgia that could be made into power. Johnny Bembry owns a tree farm in Pulaski County. He ends up with waste when he thins his trees to prevent fire and disease.
Waste from the thinning is going to have to be burned. It's either going to be burned in the woods and wasted and release carbon in that manner, or it could be burned for energy creation.
The Georgia Forestry Association, an industry group, is calling for more power plants around the state that burn biomass. They say it's a good use for leftover wood, cleaner than coal and renewable because you can keep growing trees.
They're talking about sustainability in terms of what we replant.
Vicki Weeks is with the Dogwood Alliance, which opposes biomass power.
And we're talking about we can't afford to lose 40 to 50 years in terms of CO2 uptake.
Regulators consider biomass generation carbon neutral because new trees soak up carbon dioxide from the atmosphere. But Weeks points out a key hole in that calculation. It takes time for the trees to grow back. Researchers say it actually takes about 11 years for a new tree to replace one that was cut. Marilyn Brown at Georgia Tech studies biomass.
Whether or not that's a problem depends on how threatened you think we are by climate change. I am personally feeling very threatened.
We may not have 11 years to wait for trees to grow back. Last year, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change called for rapid and far-reaching changes to reduce carbon emissions by 2030 to get climate change under control.
You can't grow a lot of trees between now and then if we rely on biomass plants to large scale over the next decade.
But on a small scale, it might make sense. Ultimately, Brown calls biomass an intermediate energy source, not the cheapest or the cleanest, but viable as one piece of a system that has lots of energy sources. That's what the timber industry is calling for, small plants scattered around the state. Andres Villegas heads the Georgia Forestry Association.
So we're talking about a few grains of sand on the beach, really, at the end of the day.
The key will be finding a balance that gets the most out of Georgia's trees and still keeps the state's forests growing and soaking up carbon. For GPB News, I'm Emily Jones.
This is Athens News Matters from WUGA News.
Hours ago, halfway around the world, the day has already begun.
Tens of thousands of people in Venezuela.
Britain is leaving the European Union.
Everyone was just running. People were crying. They were in tears. And we didn't know what was happening. Police kept telling us to move back, move back.
The thousands of protesters marched along a route.
When you need to know where the world went while you weren't looking. Morning Edition. Listen every morning.
Welcome back to Athens News Matters on WUGA. I'm Alexia Ridley.
And I'm Chris Shoup. Think for a moment about the plants outside in your garden or growing wild near where you live or work. How many of them are native plants, homegrown botanical neighbors, as it were? And how important are native plants in maintaining a healthy local ecosystem? For years, the Mimsy Lanier Center for Native Plant Studies at the State Botanical Garden of Georgia has been at the forefront of conserving, producing, and promoting native plants. Here to talk about the importance of native plants and the garden's upcoming native plant sale is Lauren Muller, conservation coordinator at the Garden. Thanks for being here today.
Thanks for having me.
So let's just start out. Why are native plants so important to our local environment?
Well, native plants in our garden can serve a function beyond just being aesthetically pleasing. So they have the ability to support the larval stage of many insects, the pollinators that we love to love. And they also support the nectar feeding adult stages of insects, our bees, our butterflies, moths, wasps, things like that. So they have the ability to serve as a food source, but also sort of a nursery for these insects that are really crucial parts of the ecosystems around us.
And so when you say crucial, expand a little bit about that. Like, why are some of these insects that you just mentioned so important?
Well, they're important agriculturally because they're pollinators of many of our food crops. So they're really important in that sense. But they're also important because they support birds. You hear a lot nowadays about declining biodiversity. And our birds are no exception. We're seeing massive declines in many of our even common bird species. And so folks think about how to support birds in their garden, and a lot of times the first thing that comes to mind is berries. Birds like to eat berries, but we're sort of forgetting that in order for birds to rear their young, they need protein sources. And what's a good protein source but a big, fat, juicy caterpillar, right? So when I say that native plants support insects and their larval stages, I mean these caterpillars that do feed birds and so on. So,
well, what are some of the more common native plants in our area?
Oh, man, we've got so many native plants, but some that we'd like to highlight this year at our native plant sale are sunflowers. Our plant of the year is the sunflower at the State Botanical Garden, and we want to highlight some of our native sunflower species. We have three that we're selling this year, and one of my favorites is the purple disc sunflower. We have lots of those. We also have a lot of native grasses. People forget about the grasses and that they can be a beautiful addition to the landscape. So think little blue stem, things like that.
Yeah, and you mentioned sunflowers. I must say they can't be very difficult to grow because from my bird feeder, when the sunflowers drop into a certain place, up pops a sunflower.
Yeah, a lot of our native species are really easy to grow. And the cool thing about these native plants that we're growing are many of them are local ecotype seeds. So their seeds were collected in the Piedmont region of the Southeast. So they're adapted to our local ecosystem. So they grow really nicely here and without a lot of inputs like fertilizer, extra water, things like that.
Let's talk about one plant in particular, milkweed. It plays a major role in attracting those monarch butterflies that are so beautiful, right?
Yes, yes. We'll be selling a few species of milkweed, but they're just a really great plant to include in your garden, especially if you have kids, because it's a really neat experience for those kids to see the monarchs laying their eggs on the plant, see the larvae hatch, and they're actually quite cute, watching them feed on the plant, turn into a really beautiful chrysalis, and then emerge again as a butterfly. So it's a really neat experience to have it, you know, in your garden.
Really cool. Well, if you're looking to incorporate native plants in your yard or garden, what are some of the best practices for, say, new gardeners?
You know, we like to say that you want to pick the right plant for the right place. So understand the environmental conditions in your yard, how much water is available, how much sunlight. And you can pick the right plant for suiting those conditions. But it's all about doing it one bit at a time. You don't have to automatically convert your whole yard to natives. You can just start by popping in some really cool native sunflowers or grasses and kind of do it bit by bit.
As I was getting ready for our conversation, I was struck by how the garden collects native plant seeds in an ethical manner. Why is that important, and what does that even mean to collect ethically?
So it means that if you're wild collecting seed, you're not taking the seed from that entire population. You're leaving enough for that plant to continue on and for it to spread its seed to natural areas, for birds to feed on. So we don't want to take all of that seed just so we can grow more of these plants or share with people, but we want to leave enough out in the wild for that plant to continue on.
So you're just careful with how you go about doing that, I guess. You keep up with sort of the what's left.
Yes. And we will have native seed available for sale at the upcoming plant sale.
Finally, the garden hosts a number of native plant sales in October. What are the dates and times?
So on October 2nd, we're hosting an opening reception, and this is really cool because folks get first choice of native plants. We'll be serving beverages and hors d'oeuvres, and they get a one-on-one interaction with native plant experts.
Wow.
Who can help plan.
Wow, that's really cool.
Yeah. And then we have the sale on October 3rd, 4th, 5th, 10th, 11th, and 12th. On Thursdays and Fridays, the sale will be from 4 p.m. to 6 p.m., and Saturdays it will be from 9 a.m. to noon. And you can register for the plant sale preview at botgarden.uga.edu. Additionally, on the website, you can find our plant list of all the plants that will be available at the sale.
Great. Well, thank you so much for coming by today to share all this with us.
Thanks for having me.
Lauren Muller is the conservation coordinator for the State Botanical Garden of Georgia. The garden is hosting a number of native plant sales through October, and you can find out more at botgarden.uga.edu.
It's been said that the only two things that are certain in life are death and taxes. You might be happy to know that the next story isn't about taxes. WUGA's Gemma DiCarlo talked to a local podcast host whose show presents death in a sometimes poignant and sometimes funny way.
The thing is, sooner or later, we're all going to die. It's a fact of life. But that doesn't mean it has to be all doom and gloom. In fact, death can be funny.
My family owns a monument company, and my dad, 21 years later, still doesn't have a monument. Because my mom would have to design it, and that is painful.
That was Funeral Stories, an Athens-based comedy podcast hosted by Laura Brooker and Casey Molino, formerly Casey Carter. The two are lifelong friends with pretty different views on death. Laura's family ran a cemetery and a monument company. But for Casey, death was less familiar.
So she had no problem like talking about what happened at the day's funeral over pork chops for dinner. So death was pretty familiar to her. And I have always had crazy death anxiety. I don't like to talk about it. Well, I used to not like to talk about it. I wanted it as far away from me as possible.
The two started the podcast in February 2018 as a way to talk about loss, destigmatize grief, and laugh at all the strange things in between.
Honestly, the only way we could handle such a heavy subject matter is by being a comedy podcast and by realizing that laughter and tears go hand in hand. So many reviews that we've gotten have said, I've cried till I've laughed and I've laughed till I cried. And I just think that that's the only way a podcast called Funeral Stories could really work, by laughing at the absurdity that is life and death.
The podcast will kick off its third season on Friday, September 27th, with a live recording at the 40 Watt. The show is billed as a night of death, drag, and dancing, which Casey says is her perfect night.
I always say I'm the love child of Dolly Parton and RuPaul, so it's kind of like my perfect mix, so I cannot wait.
The death and drag will be provided by local drag troupe, The Courtesans, who will be performing the songs that they once sung at their funerals.
And so after they perform, we're going to ask them questions about the song, their experience with death, if they have any funeral stories, and then after that, there's going to be a pretty awesome dance party with the Booty Boys.
The live show falls during Athens Pride Week, a coincidence Casey says was unplanned but actually resonates with the podcast's theme.
A lot of our episodes have centered around grief that is associated with coming out, identity issues, things like that, because a lot of times the person that's experiencing it, that's facing their identity, that's owning their identity, that's experiencing all these things, they're grieving, and their family members are. They're grieving a life that they had in mind for this person. So we talk about that a lot and the importance of being your authentic self.
To that effect, Funeral Stories will donate a portion of the live show's ticket sales to Athens Pride.
It would be wrong not to. As much as I've gotten from the community as a straight white woman, you know, it would be wrong not to give back.
As the podcast enters its third season, Casey and Laura hope to keep giving listeners a place to process their grief and loss, especially through laughter.
One day to the next is totally different when you're grieving. And sometimes your emotions are so strong, all you can do is like let out maniacal laughter. That's pretty much it.
For WUGA News, I'm Gemma DiCarlo.
Gemma DiCarlo is a segment producer for Athens News Matters.
This has been Athens News Matters from WUGA. Our senior producer is Martin Matheny, and our segment producers are Gemma DiCarlo, Morgan Fry, Alex Vandenhubel, and John Slights. The opinions expressed on this program do not necessarily reflect those of WUGA or the University of Georgia.
Don't forget, if you missed part of this week's show, you can listen again online at WUGA.org or on the NPR One app or the WUGA app, available for Apple and Android, wherever you get your apps. For Chris Shoup, I'm Alexia Ripley, and this has been Athens News Matters from WUGA News.